Good afternoon, and welcome to the Green Thumb Show. I'm Lee Murray, your reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining us. From the December-January issue of Phoenix Home and Garden Magazine, Garden Solutions, Low to Middle Elevations. Get a jump start on spring by sowing seeds for tomatoes indoors 8 to 10 weeks before planting outside to maximize the growing season. There are more varieties to choose when using seed versus transplants. Look for those that do well in the desert, such as Black Crim, Black Plum, Celebrity, and Early Girl. Refer to the timeline on the seed packet for each type to see how long it will take from planting to maturity and plan accordingly. Once temperatures hit 90 degrees and above, tomatoes will no longer produce viable pollen and fruit production will be halted, so the sooner you can plant them, the better. Add fruit trees such as apples, apricots, peaches, and plums sold as bare root or in a nursery container. Select a location away from walls and hard surfaces with reflected heat. Create a hole that is 3 times wider than the root ball and backfill with existing soil. After planting, add a 3-inch layer of organic mulch such as bark chips, extending 3 feet out from the base and 6 inches from the trunk, which helps moderate soil temperatures and reduces the heat from landscape rock. Don't fertilize the first year after planting so that roots have a better chance to grow, which is vital for vigorous top growth later. Feed flowering annuals and vegetables in the garden, which are actively growing this time of year and require a regular supply of nutrients. Select an organic fertilizer specially formulated for each type of plant, which lasts longer than synthetic blends without the danger of overapplication and burning plants. Adjust your controller so it irrigates less frequently. Plants don't need as much moisture in winter as in summer, as colder temperatures cause them to stop actively growing. Unfortunately, overwatering is a common mistake, resulting in overly wet soil, declining plant health, and a higher water bill. Utilize well-researched interactive watering guidelines from Water Use It Wisely. The website is wateruseitwisely.com/saving-water-outdoors/interactive-watering-guides, tailored to seasonal irrigation needs. From USA Today, buying a real Christmas tree this season? Here's how to pick and care for one. By George Petras and Jennifer Borison. Christmas is coming up fast, and you're thinking about presents, house decorations, and putting up a tree. What's your tree plan this year? Lugging home a Christmas tree and decorating it in the living room is a family tradition for many of us. Whether it's real or artificial, Christmas trees are the centerpieces of the holiday. Though artificial trees remain popular, more families have become interested in fresh Christmas trees in recent years, a shift powered by young families wanting a memorable experience for their children and a desire for a product that's recyclable and biodegradable, according to the Retail Christmas Tree Board, a promotional organization for tree growers. The tree size and shape will be different from last year, but what won't change is the fragrance of the tree, the aroma that evokes memories of holidays gone by. Scent is the top reason people decide to buy a real tree, the board says. Here are a few quick tips if you're getting a real tree this Christmas. So what type of Christmas tree should you get? First on the list here is a Fraser fir. Fraser firs are a popular choice for Christmas trees. They have blue-green needles with silvery undersides, and their branches are strong enough for heavy ornaments, Michigan State University says. Douglas fir is next. While not a true fir tree, Douglas firs are commonly used as Christmas trees in western states, according to the National Forest Foundation. The needles are sweet-smelling. Blue spruce. Blue spruce trees, also known as Colorado blue spruce, are popular Christmas tree choices in the eastern U.S., says the National Christmas Tree Association. The trees are blue-gray with sharp needles that can be more than an inch long. White pine. White pines, or eastern white pines, is a common Christmas choice in eastern states, says Cornell University's Cooperative Extension. Their needles range from blue-green to silver-green and are 2 to 5 inches long. Scots pine. Scots pine, also called Scotch pines, are widely used as Christmas trees because of their shape and ability to retain their needles, says the Arbor Day Foundation. They grow in an oval shape and have blue-green needles. There are nearly two dozen species of trees that can be used for Christmas, the Real Christmas Tree Board says. Your choice may be influenced on what is available near you. So where should you get your Christmas tree? Pre-cut trees are commonly offered for sale in parking lots of retail centers. Some of these are operated by charity organizations. You could cut your own tree at a local Christmas tree farm, which grows and sells trees like crops. Buying from a farm supports local tree farmers who plant 1 to 3 seedlings for every tree sold, which helps maintain healthy forests according to the Nature Conservancy. Garden centers, local retailers, and home improvement centers are also good sources for a Christmas tree, the Real Christmas Tree Board says. Nearly all retail locations will bale trees, making it easier for you to get it home, the board says. If you're looking to find a tree farm, a farm locator is available from the National Christmas Tree Association, a promotional organization. What should you look for in a Christmas tree? First, measure the space where the tree will be displayed, both ceiling height and width of the area, says Bert Craig, associate professor and extension specialist of horticulture and forestry at Michigan State University. You don't want to buy a tree, get it home, and find out it's too tall for the room. Use the simple pull test to see if the tree is fresh. Pull firmly on a branch or two to see if any needles come off in your hand, Craig says. If they do, the tree is too dry. Where in the house should you set up your Christmas tree? If your tree is baled, keep it that way until you get it inside. It's easier to handle that way. Once in the tree stand, remove the netting and fluff the branches. Your tree stand should be wide and sturdy, the Real Christmas Tree Board says. It should also have a water reservoir large enough to keep your tree watered. A tree can drink about 1/4 of water per inch of trunk diameter, the board says. Keep the tree away from heating vents, which can dry it out quickly. It's best to use electrical outlets that are close by and limit use of extension cords. How should you decorate your Christmas tree? The choice of Christmas tree decorations is a matter of personal preference. It could be as simple or elaborate as you like. If you're using electric lights, make sure they are in good shape. Lights with old wires or other deterioration should not be used. LED Christmas lights produce less heat than the small incandescent bulbs your grandparents used, but they cost more than traditional lights. Make sure all the lights work before installing them. How should you care for your Christmas tree? If you do not intend on setting your tree up right away, store the tree in a bucket of water in a cool place, out of the sun and protected from the wind. Do not let your tree run out of water. Don't let the tree dry out. Do not add sugar, aspirin, bleach, or floral preservatives. Plain tap water is all that is needed to keep your tree fresh. As a general rule, stands should provide 1 quart of water per inch of stem diameter. One of the biggest problems is that once people put their tree into water, they don't check it until the next day or so. A tree will drink 65% of its water in the first week. Tree stands with small water reservoirs cannot hold the amount of water the tree needs in the first few days after being cut. How long should your Christmas tree stay up? With proper maintenance, live trees can stay up for about 5 weeks, according to Country Living. Check the water level in the base and top up as needed to prevent the tree from drying out and becoming a fire hazard. When the needles start turning brown, it's time for disposal. How should you dispose of your Christmas tree? Real Christmas trees are biodegradable, the National Christmas Tree Organization stresses. That means they can be recycled as mulch or as habitat projects. Check with your community Department of Public Works to see if it offers curbside tree pickup or a place where you can drop a tree off. Make sure you've removed all decorations from the tree before disposing of it. Also from USA Today, Frost Protection for Plants, Tips from Gardening Experts for the Winter, by Olivia Munson. During the frigid months, there are ways to prevent yourself from getting frosty. But what about your plants? How can you protect them from those wintry visits from Jack Frost? If you live in an area where the weather isn't always hospitable, you might have experienced losing a plant or two when the temperatures drop. Sometimes we forget to cover our plants or can't relocate certain crops in time before the weather changes. But there are methods and measures to protect your plants according to gardening and horticulture experts. Here's what you need to know. How to protect plants from frost. There is not a one-size-fits-all answer when it comes to protecting plants from frost. It depends on a whole bunch of different factors, says Dave Whittinger, Executive Director of the National Gardening Association. Each area has its own weather and landscape, so it's hard to lump every gardening experience together. Vegetation or flowers that thrive in one part of the country may differ from another. If you're going to plant something in the ground, it's best, if you can help it, to choose something that's designed to withstand the cold in your area, says Whittinger. The best place to start is to look at the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Plant Hardiness Zone map. The map helps gardeners and growers learn what plants can actually tolerate their specific location, said Cheryl Boyer, a professor in the Department of Horticulture and Natural Resources at Kansas State University. The hardiness zone map uses the average annual extreme minimum winter temperature as a guide to divide the U.S. and Puerto Rico into 13 zones, according to the USDA. On its website, you can input your zip code to determine your hardiness zone. A lot of plants, especially ornamentals, will be ranked according to their cold hardiness zone, said Boyer. From there, you can decide what perennials or plants that live for more than 2 years are best suited to where you are. So what happens to plants in the winter? It's easy to assume a plant is dead if it has become brown and shriveled, but this isn't always the case. We have a lot of plants, like perennials, that will just lose the top herbaceous parts, said Boyer. In the soil, the roots will be fine. It'll pop up new shoots in the spring when it warms up again. There is no need to worry if your roses or tulips have seemingly dried up. If plants are in the correct hardiness zone, they will go dormant in the winter and regrow again once the temperatures go back up. Many plants can hold up against cold temperatures. Woody plants, such as pine trees, are usually safe from frost depending on where you live, said Boyer. Another example is oregano, which is usually okay in cold temperatures, says Whittinger. Plant frost prevention methods. If you're looking to give your plants some extra protection from the cold, there are several measures to take. You can place boxes, buckets, or nursery containers on top of your plants to protect them from a light or medium frost, says Whittinger. However, this won't completely protect them from extremely cold temperatures. There are also different types of fabric and plastic options to lightly drape over your plants for short-term protection, said Boyer. If it's going to be an extended period of cold weather, you want to make sure that the leaves are not touching the edge of that cover, she said, explaining, if the leaves come in contact with the cover, the plant could freeze. If you surround it with some protection, it'll have its own humidity and warmth. If your plants are in pots or containers, you can bring them inside your home or in the garage to prevent them from getting frost. Dealing unpredictable seasons. While we try our best to predict the weather, things don't always go as planned. One day could be relatively warm for the season, and the next is back to freezing. It may feel like nature's trying to trick you, but it's not. In these cases, it's best to be scientific about caring for your plants, said Whittinger. If the average temperature is still relatively low, don't let one random warm day or two convince you to start planting. You really should wait, he said. This is the number one cause of people failing in their vegetable gardening, is by planting at the wrong time. In general, it's important to keep an eye on the weather via alerts or applications, said Boyer. This will let you know what is coming to your area, whether it be rain, frost, or freeze. Here's another article from USA Today. Record 77 Arizona bald eagle hatchlings fledge this year, by Karen Bartonek. The population of southwestern bald eagles, or Arizona bald eagles, in the state reached a record high this year with dozens of new hatchlings, according to the Arizona Game and Fish Department. This breeding season, the eagles laid at least 119 eggs, resulting in 96 hatchlings. Of those, 77 successfully fledged, taking their first flight. There were 104 documented breeding areas statewide, including 7 new sites this year, Arizona Game and Fish Department added. Arizona's bald eagle population continues to be strong, said Kenneth Tuck Jacobson, Game and Fish Bald Eagle Management Coordinator. The fact that we continue to see an increase in breeding areas and hatchlings speaks to the resiliency of these magnificent animals and the effectiveness of ongoing efforts to help conserve and protect Arizona's bald eagles. In 2010, after a two-year review, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service determined that the Arizona bald eagles in Arizona did not require continued protection under the Endangered Species Act. The species was officially removed from the endangered species list the following year. The Arizona Game and Fish Department supported the recognition of the population as a distinct segment for biological reasons. The department believed that the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act, along with its comprehensive bald eagle management program, would ensure the ongoing success of the eagles in the Sonoran Desert. The department plans on continuing with its conservation strategies that aided in the current record population of bald eagles in Arizona. Here's a recent column that appeared in the Arizona Republic. These are Arizona's 10 Most Fearsome Insects and Reptiles by Tiffany Acosta. Arizona's diverse wildlife includes some of the most painful and poisonous creatures found in the desert. From the excruciating sting of the tarantula hawk wasp to the potentially life-threatening bite of the western diamondback rattlesnake, the state is home to a variety of insects, arachnids, and reptiles capable of delivering intense pain or potent venom. The Arizona bark scorpion, with its sharp electric sting, and the aggressive Africanized honeybee, known for its painful stings and swarming behavior, further highlight the potential risks. Meanwhile, the giant desert centipede and desert hairy scorpion, though less deadly, still pose significant discomfort. Here is everything you need to know about the 10 meanest bugs in Arizona. Arizona bark scorpion. The Arizona bark scorpion delivers an intensely painful sting, often described as sharp and electric, causing numbness, tingling, and muscle spasms. The venom, while rarely fatal, can cause severe symptoms such as difficulty breathing, particularly in children and older people. Immediate medical attention is recommended, especially if symptoms are severe. While waiting for help, applying ice can help reduce pain, and over-the-counter pain relievers may offer some relief. Stay calm and immobilize the affected area to slow the spread of venom. Gila monster. When a Gila monster bites, it chews venom into the wound, causing intense burning, swelling, and a feeling of pressure. The venom is potent, not usually deadly, but it can lead to significant discomfort, dizziness, nausea, and a drop in blood pressure. Seek medical attention to manage pain and monitor for complications. While waiting for help, keep the bite area immobilized and elevated. Avoid using a tourniquet or trying to suck out the venom. Tarantula hawk wasp. The tarantula hawk wasp sting is often described as a searing electric shock that can incapacitate its victim temporarily. While the venom is highly toxic to insects and paralyzes them, it is not lethal to humans. The pain, however, can last for several hours, often accompanied by redness and swelling. Africanized honeybee. The sting of an Africanized honeybee, also known as a killer bee, is similar to that of a typical honeybee, but more intense. And because of the bee's aggressive swarming behavior, you might be stung multiple times. The venom causes a sharp burning pain and redness, swelling, and itching at the sting site. While the venom of one bee is not typically deadly to humans, multiple stings or an allergic reaction can be dangerous. Western diamondback rattlesnake. One of the most dangerous animals you can get bitten by in Arizona is the western diamondback rattlesnake. Symptoms include intense throbbing, swelling, and tissue damage. The venom is potent and can cause severe pain, necrosis, nausea, dizziness, and difficulty breathing. A western diamondback rattlesnake bite is a serious emergency requiring immediate attention. Anti-venom and other treatments are necessary to prevent severe complications. Black widow spider. A black widow spider can cause a sharp burning sensation that can escalate to severe muscle cramps and rigidity. The venom is neurotoxic and can lead to nausea, sweating, and severe abdominal pain, though it is rarely fatal. Desert hairy scorpion is next. According to Blue Sky Pest Control, a pest control service in Metro Phoenix, a sting from a desert hairy scorpion causes moderate pain similar to that of a bee sting with localized swelling and redness. The venom is not highly toxic to humans and is less severe compared to other scorpions. Blister beetle. Blister beetles do not bite or sting. Instead, they can release a toxin called cantharidin if crushed against the skin. This toxin isn't deadly, but does cause painful blisters. Giant desert centipede. According to Orkin, the giant desert centipede's bite can cause sharp burning pain and significant swelling. Its venom, while potent to its prey, is not usually deadly to humans, but can lead to severe discomfort and localized inflammation. Self-care remedies, such as applying ice and using pain relievers, can help. Rounding out the list of Arizona's 10 most fearsome insects and reptiles, red imported fire ant. According to Orkin, the sting of a red imported fire ant starts with a burning sensation that intensifies and can lead to the formation of small, pus-filled blisters. The venom contains alkaloids that cause intense pain and itching. While the venom is not typically deadly, multiple stings or an allergic reaction can be dangerous. Remove any stingers promptly and wash the area with soap and water. Seek immediate medical attention if you experience severe symptoms such as difficulty breathing or widespread swelling, as these may indicate a serious allergic reaction. Those of you who are regular listeners to this show know we feature stories each week from the terrific book, Chicken Soup for the Gardener's Soul. This story has a holiday theme, is written by Sherry Andrewich. It's called The Wreath. And there's a quote here from James Russell Lowell. Children are God's apostles, day by day sent forth to preach of love and hope and peace. The Wreath. For their Christmas holiday project, Cassie's Bluebird Troop planned to visit a nursing home. Folks in nursing homes are often too old or too sick to be home alone, Mrs. Peters, the group leader, told the little girls. Maybe they have no relatives, maybe families are far away or unable to help. We're going to cheer them with carols and bring them gifts we've made. Placing the last flower on her wreath, Cassie wondered about the person whose name she drew, Mabel, somewhere between 60 and 80. Not yet 10, Cassie had difficulty identifying with old. Her grandparents played golf, traveled a lot, and had plenty of loving relatives. Outside, a car horn blared. Cassie scooped up her wreath and rushed to join her friends. The Bluebirds, a junior version of Campfire Girls, soon arrived at a modest cottage. A matron greeted them enthusiastically. "The folks are just so looking forward to your visit," she said with a smile. Stepping onto the cottage's smooth linoleum floor, Cassie sniffed a strong, disinfectant odor. Mrs. Peters sounded a pitch on her harmonica and led the troop in, "We wish you a Merry Christmas." Singing along, Cassie gazed at one wrinkled face after another, some smiling, some sad, some apathetic. One elderly woman turned her face to the wall. As the matron announced the little girls would be circulating among the residents with gifts, a man in a wheelchair spun forward. He wagged his finger fiercely at the visitors. "What right do you have coming here, reminding us of families we don't have?" he shouted. "Once a year somebody comes here. Take your do-gooding pity and get out." Wide-eyed, some of the girls backed away, but Mrs. Peters coaxed them forward again as the matron calmed the grumbling man. Shaken but determined, Cassie asked a group of card players, "Please, where can I find Mabel?" A lady with bright orange hair gestured toward the window. "Over there," she said cheerfully, "and don't pay these grouches any mind. You kids are okay." Timidly clutching her wreath, Cassie approached the straight-backed figure surrounded by soft winter light. "Mabel?" The gray head with a proud French roll at its crown didn't move. Mabel, if this was Mabel, continued gazing out the window at the darkening California desert. Cassie set her wreath on the worn, polished surface of a table by her side. Taking a deep breath, she stared at it, as if memorizing every leaf. "I made this wreath for you," she said. "I know it's just homemade, but there's a story for every twig and flower. I came to tell you about them. The base is made from pine branches. Some were easy to bend, and some I had to soak in water to shape the frame. It's all natural, and gathering the flowers was fun, because I remember where each one grew." Her courage up now, Cassie talked faster, touching the wreath as she spoke. "The wild sunflowers are from a vacant lot by my house. Someone is going to build new homes there, so by spring the sunflowers will be all gone. These dried desert flowers, the mustard, sage, and lavender smell so good and they'll last a long time. Rabbit foot fern is from my patio garden and so is the baby's breath. I caught the gold and red maple leaves when they blew across our lawn. I found a few little pine cones too. And in the center is a star white cactus flower. Mom says it's kind of unusual for this time of year. Slowly, Mabel turned around. Eyes undimmed by age, searched Cassie's. I sit by this window, she said quietly, because I miss the outdoors so. Thank you for bringing it inside. A trembling hand, clustered with brown spots, reached over and grasped Cassie's. I, too, remember where the flowers grew. Merry Christmas, child. That's called The Wreath, written by Sherry Androvich, one of the many stories that make up chicken soup for the gardener's soul. And that's the Green Thumb Show for this week. For Sun Sounds Radio, I'm Lee Murray, your reader. Thanks for joining us. Have a great week. Be safe and healthy, and we'll be talking with you soon.